simple terms, because you probably relate to it more effectively, what's called Tzvei Dinim, the idea that almost kemat, every subject can be viewed from different perspectives. And the truth of the matter is that I think that Rav Soloveitchik utilized this approach not only, shall we say, in learning, but also his entire approach. If you read his articles, his philosophic pieces, this is a philosophic piece that the Rav wrote. And not only that, but also his approach to Tanakh, almost everything reflects this dialectical approach to everything. The Rav was very into dialectic, and I think his, shall we say, even existentialism, because he was an existentialist, I'm not going to go into that right now, maybe another occasion, also reflected very much this duality. And the Rav saw, came out everywhere, the nature of man as being really of a dual nature. I'll just give you, I just wrote that for myself a few moments ago, a number of articles that the Rav discussed this issue. On the one hand, the human being is a subject, is a gabra. On the other hand, he can be a chefza. The Rav was, of course, that's a well-known Talmudic notion, which we find all over the place. The Rav speaks in another article about what he calls Isha Goral, Isha Yehud, man of fate and man of destiny. The distinction between the two is one is a more active, one is more passive. Or the most famous, Adam 1, Adam 2, of the lonely man of faith, two different personalities, typologically, two different, really, totally different genre. One, of course, is concerned with, shall we say, more spiritual matters, the other with physical matters. Ahava versus Yira, which in the Rambam, the Rav also used that, there's a dialectical tension. The way the Rambam describes Ahava, a person is longing to connect with Hashem, but at the moment that a person realizes, I'm in the presence of Hashem, he recoils, because he realizes he's but a cipher, he's but a speck of dust in terms of his the entire universe. The Rav used to quote from the Kutzker Rebbe that every person has two pockets. On the one hand, one pocket says, "V'anochi ofar ve'efer," we are dust, we are nothingness. On the other hand, the other pocket has the pasuk quoted by the Ramban in Bereshit, where the Torah speaks about man created b'tzelem Elokim, v'techasrei miyad me'elokim. A person could achieve unbelievable heights, could rise to incredible levels. Rav Soloveitchik was very fond of two paragraphs that are found in the Ilah of Yom Kippurim that really very much are in contrast with one another. One paragraph speaks about havel havalim, that the human being essentially is, shall we say, replete with vanity, hakol havel, and our situation is, shall we say, pretty, we are, to a large extent, let's put it in very blunt terms, low lives. On the other hand, we have the notion of the other paragraph in the Ilah, which is Ata hivdalta enesh merosh b'tamidei ulamod lefanecha, and the ability of a person to rise to unbelievable heights. I gave you a number of examples. Come out, every one of these is another philosophic piece that Rav Soloveitchik wrote, and essentially he saw things as you have the notion of what he called shnei hafachim b'nosei echad. Each topic has shnei hafachim, has two sides to the coin, and that's how we have to examine. And the human being, of course, is, as you, I don't know if you read this piece, so maybe I'll just go over it with you, but the reason why I decided to use this piece, Majesty and Humility, it happens to have a Gemara in Sanhedrin that I learned recently in the fourth parak that speaks about the fact, and Rashi quotes in the Chumash, Rashi said there are two ways of understanding how Adam HaRishon was created. Either Hashem gathered Afar, Mikol, literally Afrot Tevel, from the entire cosmos, or Adam HaRishon was actually, Afar was taken from the Mizbeach, was taken from one very specific area. And that also, the Rav is going to describe two different persona, two different types of human beings. Now this essay here, Majesty and Humility, has some of the most important ideas in Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy. And really, it's a mafteach to understanding, especially some of his longer pieces, The Lonely Man of Faith, Isha Emunah Bodeid. And the title already indicates to you already some of what I just spoke about a moment ago, namely, Majesty and Humility. On the one hand, majesty, of course, represents, if you will, the sense of grandeur and the sense of malchut, majesty, or inheres in majesty the idea of malchut. On the other hand, humility, of course, seems to be at the very opposite pole. And the title here that the Rav wants to emphasize, it refers to characteristics of both Hashem and the human being. means human morality, as you know, has to imitate Hashem's qualities. That's based on the Gemara Masechah Sota Daf Yudalid that Rav Soloveitchik was very fond of. I'll describe that in a few moments. Namely, Behalachta Bidvachav. That notion of Halachta Bidvachav is otherwise known as Imitatio Dei, as Rav Soloveitchik used to describe. Mahu Af Ata. Namely, the Gemara says over there, Mahu Mevaker Cholim Af Ata Tvaker Cholim. We have to emulate the attributes of Hashem. As you know, the Rambam and Ramban both interpret Psukim in Pashas Kisisa, where there are two requests that Moshe Rabbeinu makes of Hashem. One is Harini Nat Kodecha, and one is Hodieni Nat Rachecha. What are these two requests? So the Rambam and Ramban, the Rambam is found in Moreh Nevuchim. The Rambam also has reference to it a number of other times in his writings, and the Ramban writes it very clearly in his Perush Al Torah. What are the two requests? One request was, I want to connect with Hashem, and Hashem answered that request, Hodieni Nat Rachecha, in the positive, in the affirmative. Namely, how do we connect with Hashem? Through Yud Gimel Midos Rachamim, through the 13 attributes of faith that Hasaradim HaTohorim say every day, and HaAshkenazim HaLokol Kach Tohorim do not say on a daily basis, Monday and Thursday, many, and some only, not even on Monday and Thursday, but shall we say only on very special occasions. So that is one request. The other request was Harini Nog Tvodecha, to know the Mahut of Hashem, to understand the essence of Hashem, and that the response was Ki Lo Yirani HaAdam V'Chai. It's impossible. There's no way one could possibly plumb the essence of Hashem, but these are two requests. And if you will, in some sense, that actually these two requests also reflected here. On the one hand, one can get a sense of the majesty of Hashem through his attributes. That's the only way we connect to Hashem. On the other hand, there is a sense of humility that at the end of the day, we are afar ve'efer, and we can never really come to the understanding of the Mahut of Hashem and Barach. Even Moshe Rabbeinu only reached the 49th level, was not able to achieve the highest of levels. So this idea of Halachta Bidvachav, which the Gemara has in Sota, Daf Yudalid, is something which is very critical for us to be cognizant of. So just as Hashem is Barach, if you will, is operating, on the one hand, he is in his own realm, on the other hand, he does connect with human beings, so we are obligated to go ahead and recognize our humanity, our finitude, the fact that we are not infinite, we are finite, Hashem is infinite. On the other hand, there are ways of connecting with Hashem. Now, the Rav is going to speak about this idea that I began with, namely the notion of dialect. Dialectical, human morality is dialectical. If you take a look at page 25 here, the first page, the introduction to this piece. Man is a dialectical being, an inner schism runs through his personality at every level. Means there are two opposing movements which have to be maintained, tvei dinim, in a tense kind of balance. That's Rav Soloveitchik's favorite theme, I would say probably his most pronounced theme, and both are necessary. We have to operate with both at the same time. And again, the Rav points out, the schism is not because we are rebelling against our Maker. This, by the way, is a Christological notion since the days of Augustine, as the Rav pointed out, means since original sin. Once the chet of Adam and Rishon occurred, essentially, we are, according to the Catholic perspective of the matter, there is, shall we say, as you can see over here, unlike this view, according to which it was man who by sinful rebellion precipitated the split in human nature, that is not a Jewish perspective. The Jewish perspective is, on the contrary, that this dialectic, namely this tension, these opposing kind of movements, is exactly built into the very nature of what man is all about. Okay, the Rav expresses it in his usual, very, how shall we say, as someone here told me, a Shana Aleph student, highfalutin fashion. The Rav writes over here, man is always in a state of ontological tenseness and perplexity. But that, to Rav Soloveitchik, is something which is built in. And as I said, this is the notion of a halachta bidracha. That's how Rav Soloveitchik understands it. It's part of the very nature of what we're obligated to do. Now, you know, the pasuk of Halachta Bidrachav happens to be found in actually in Sefer Dvarim, Perachav Chet. Okay, you don't have a chumash in front of you. But there, the Torah says that Hashem is going to establish us as a Am Kadosh only if we keep the commandments of Hashem, Behalachta Bidrachav. And even though it's phrased there as a kind of conditional statement, it's not a command, it's not a tzivui. Well, Bechalzot, the fact of the matter is that there are many interpretations. If you take a look, for example, there's a very famous tshuva, Rabbi Avraham and Rambam, the Rambam's son. He is concerned about this issue, that Balachta Bidvachav is found as a bilashon tzinai. It's not found as a kind of tzivui, as a kind of command. And he discusses this, but there are other places also where we see that we're obligated to go ahead, and that's the Gemara in Sota that I mentioned to you. It's a Sifrei in Dvarim, and this is a very clear position that's found among the Dalai HaRishonim. I'll just read you first the Gemara in Sota, if you don't mind. It says, Achrei Hashem Elokechem Teilechu. The Gemara asks, can a person actually walk after Hashem? It says, Hashem Eish Ochla. Hashem is an all-consuming fire. How do we walk after Hashem? So the Gemara says, what it means is, Mahu Afata. By the way, our Salvezi went further. The Gemara says, Mahu Rachum Afata Rachum, Mahu Chanun Afata Chanun, Mahu Bevake Cholim Afata Bevake Cholim, Mahu Nachem Avelim Afata Nachem Avelim. How does the Rav read into the Gemara, which is not found in the Gemara? Mahu Mechadesh Olamot Afata Techadesh Olamot. Just like Hashem is creative and creates worlds, we're also obligated to be creative and create worlds. Creativity. That's one of the Rav's favorite themes, the idea of creativity, and he claims that this is part of V'alachta B'drocha. When you look in Hilchot Deot, as you know, this again is, I think, very much reflected in the Rambam, Mishmona Prokim, and Hilchot Deos, and the Mar Nebuchim. The Rambam has the famous Shvil HaZahav. What's the Shvil HaZahav? The Rambam said we should try to choose which path? The so-called golden mean, or the middle path. And the Rambam, for example, Hilchot Deos, when he talks about, shall we say, different character traits, there are those that we should go to one extreme, and that's very clear. For example, which one is the Rambam most well known for? One should go to the other extreme, that's the Midah Vanava of modesty, because it says Me'od Me'od Hevishvavuach, the double language, and so we should avoid that, really. But in general, Rov Hamidot, we should follow the Derech HaMutzah. And this idea of the middle kind of road, which the Rambam has many, many times, as I said, a number of places, both in Mishnah Torah, he also has it here in Mor Nebuchim, he also has it in his in the Shmona Prokim. These are very important Svarim, but the reason why I mention this is because in effect, what you see from the Rambam is that they're already, and the Rav actually has a very nice way of putting it. In the bottom of 25, he writes, Judaism accepted a dialectic consisting only of thesis and antithesis. The third Hegelian stage, that of reconciliation, is missing. Only Hashem knows how to reconcile. We do not. Complete reconciliation is eschatological vision. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The notion that we know there are, for example, two Eish Umayim. How is the world able to exist with these two, shall we say, forces that are clearly in contradiction with each other? So of course the answer is, Hashem knows how to reconcile between fire and water. And fire and water are representative of two poles, almost like two opposites, that are operating in conjunction with each other. So the Rav says over here that essentially he talks about the philosophic terminology, that's what he calls here Hegel. Hegel's one of a great philosopher. He speaks about thesis and antithesis. And of course, when the tension between the two eventually leads to a third hybrid position, that's called, as Asolvetic said over here, synthesis. If you have a dialectic, it only has two sides, doesn't have any harmonious kind of resolution, that's called actually a kind of Kierkegaardian dialectic. The 19th century Danish theologian Kierkegaard, very well known for, the Rebbe was very fond of him for a number of reasons, I'm not going to get into it right now, but there you have three positions, namely you have synthesis at the end, but you have thesis and antithesis, or you call thesis and antithesis tvei dinim, and if you wish, the third, the harmony or the reconciliation is something which is a Hegelian dialectic. But the Rebbe takes a very clear, take a look at page 25 and then going on to 26 is what he writes over here. He says that the He writes that, again, Judaic dialectic is irreconcilable and interminable. To Hegel, man and history were just abstract ideas. In the world of abstraction, synthesis is conceivable. To Judaism, man has always been and is still a living reality. I'm skipping a little bit. In the world of reality, the harmony of opposites is an impossibility. So this notion that Rav Soloveitchik has, what he's saying is that both of these poles are, shall we say, operative simultaneously. It's possible to have two opposite poles and they operate with this kind of tension, and this is an ongoing kind of tension, part of the dialectical being of man. And that's what the Rav speaks about here when he talks about the inner schism, and therefore we are, shall we say, in constant, I would say, conflict. There's constant conflict between these two opposing forces and ideas. And now, just to show you, on page number 26, going a bit further, he quotes the pasuk, "Ani amarti b'chazi kol adam kozev." This is from the Tehillim, from Hallel. All men are liars. What exactly is the nature of this statement? Doesn't seem. And the Rav has a whole discussion what this statement is referring to. Are we talking about a dishonest businessman? Are we talking about politicians who engage in pathological liars? Are we talking about someone who's perjures himself in court? Does it talk about a profitable, immoral lie? So the Rav said, what is the David HaMelech concerned with? The existential lie that man tells, not to others, but to himself. Man is indeed a liar in the middle of page 26, because he's involved in an unresolvable contradiction, in an insoluble dialectic. He's caught like Avram's ram in a thicket of antinomies and dichotomies. He swings like a pendulum between two poles. The thesis, the antithesis, the affirmation, negation. And he can't identify himself with either, both of them, but with neither. He must lie. But this is the rooted in man's uniqueness, going on to the next page, and a certain agony. Torn man. Basically, a man is torn between different poles, and this is called the dialectical movement, if you will, that apparently, according to Rasalvetsky, is very inherent in what Judaism is all about. And now, here, he begins to go on page number 27 and 28. That's the Gemara that I mentioned to you before in Sanhedrin, that the Gemara says, on the one hand, Hashem created man, Savar Afaro Mikol Adama Me'abar Ruchot, for the four corners. And then on the next page, he quotes from Rashi, that Rashi said, Darachem Natal Afaro Mimakom Shenem Abo Mizbach Adama Taseli. So what exactly, here seems to be a contradiction of these two positions. So the Rav said, no, it's not a contradiction. And that's what he writes on page number 28. You look in the, directly below that statement in Chazal. Man was created of cosmic dust. That's the first Chazal. Hashem gathered the dust from all parts of the earth. Man belongs everywhere. He's no stranger to any part of the universe. And then he, the Rav, goes on the next two or three pages to discuss this cosmic aspect of man. And the cosmic aspect is, he talks about intellectual curiosity that man has, and he speaks about, shall we say, the notion of Lashem Ha'aretz Imlo'a, the fact that we want to go ahead and explore the dark interplanetary or interstellar spaces. And on page number 29, man is cosmic, as the Rav describes over here, emotionally as well. He wants to be everywhere. Man is questing. He wants to experience the universe, explorer and adventurer. He's out to see the world. And finally, through his mobility, on the bottom of 29. Man is a mobile being. He can detach himself. His ability to adapt himself is compared to a tree of the field. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh Lavon Panecha B'Matzor. And his greatness finds expression in his ceaseless mobility. Now this is, if you will, cosmic man. And he completes this over here on page number 30, on the top of page 30. And maybe I'll just mention to you, and then we'll get to the second, shall we say, element of man, which is found in that other Chazal, that man was created from the dust of the Mizbeach. Rav Soloveitchik, this is a story that I heard. I mentioned this story here before, but perhaps you may not recall, so I'll mention it again. There was a, I went to a shir of Rav Soloveitchik in Manhattan for 13 years, a shir in Moriah. So a shul in Manhattan, I don't think the shul is, actually the rabbi of the shul just passed away. Rav Yossi Weiss, that's all. He was a great Talmud Chacham. He said the shir in Isavet and Yerodea in YU. He was a Talmud Rav Soloveitchik. He actually majored in physics in YU. I never thought he spoke English. He wore a long black coat. I thought he was a European fella. And then once I came to a funeral, a levaya, and he was the speaker. And all of a sudden he starts and he begins to speak in the king's English, not just English, but really a very, very flamboyant kind of Rav Soloveitchik type of English. I was shocked. I thought he was European. I only spoke to him in Yiddish. He spoke to me in Yiddish. So I didn't have a clue. He was an American-born fellow. Didn't even know. Anyway, so he was, he said the shir in Yerodea for many years. Okay, so I went to Moriah, and I sat next to a doctor who happens to be the Rav's doctor. Rav Soloveitchik had a doctor, Baruch Hashem, Hashem should give him a Arichas Yom B'Shonim. And so the reason why I know him, because my brother, Zichrono Livracha, was his accountant, this doctor. I discovered that also in the course of sitting next to him. Anyway, so he told me the following story. He said when he decided to go into medicine, he asked three Gedolei Yisrael what he should do. And these are the three Gedolei Yisrael. First, he went to Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal. Rav Moshe told him, enter an area of medicine where there will be minimal Chilul Shabbos. Rav Moshe being the great posek that he was, he felt that Shabbos was critical, and the doctor should try to enter an area of medicine where he will not be involved in any Chilul Shabbos. Okay. So Rav Moshe told him to become a radiologist. Because that time radiology, and even on Yom HaZeh, radiology really is not karuch with a lot of Chilul Shabbos. You can more or less be a radiologist. You're looking at obviously all kinds of x-rays and what have you. I have in my neighborhood a whole group of radiologists, some of them in my shul, and they actually have an office in my neighborhood, and that's what they do. They essentially examine x-rays, Baruch Hashem, and one of them is even a diagnostic radiologist. He actually tells doctors, he has several more years of medical school, and he tells doctors how to do surgery. He's really he's also a brilliant doctor. Okay, that's the first gadol that he went to. Then he went to a second gadol, Lubavitcher Rebbe, Tzchein Lebracha, Alava Shalom, Zechel Tzadik Lebracha. Anyway, so he went to Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe told him he should enter an area of medicine where, in effect, he will address individuals who have low self-esteem, and he will somehow build up their self-esteem. Because self-esteem is a very significant aspect of a person's growth. And he told him to become a dermatologist. Because people with skin conditions often suffer from low self-esteem. They're self-conscious of their situation. And therefore he said, you should become a dermatologist, help mankind in that kind of fashion. Then he went to Rabbi Soloveitchik. And the Rav told him the following. This is what he told me. That you should enter an area of medicine where you will push the frontiers of medicine forward. You'll discover new technologies. You'll uncover, you'll ferret out different genes that are responsible for illnesses. This is what the Rav told him 60 years ago. I just find it to be uncanny. That's Rav Soloveitchik. And you will, in effect, become someone who is obviously a great explorer of medicine and the human body, and someone who will literally be mechadish. The creativity that you will demonstrate means the other two Gedolei Yisrael, again, Chas V'Shalom, not detracting from them in any way. One is concerned about Shabbos, which is obviously a very significant concern. The other is concerned about self-esteem, also a very significant concern. And the Rav, what is his concern? To push the frontiers of medicine forward, and the excitement that you're going to encounter, and also the discoveries that you will, Mitz Hashem, present to the world, and the ability to address. And the Rav told him, hopefully you'll be able to resolve cancer cells. The Rav told this to him 60 years ago. You'll be able to address the issue of cancer and somehow find a cure, hopefully, it's Hashem, to that entire. So it just gives you a sense of where Rav Soloveitchik is coming from, his whole mindset. Okay, I'm back here on page 30, and this gives you the second statement of Chazal, which I just mentioned a moment ago, namely the fact that Adam HaRishon was created from the Afar HaMizbeach. So here the Rav said, this is not the cosmic aspect of man as the first Chazal, but rather, he has the Rav, what is man? Not cosmopolitan, but provincial. A villager. And this is the notion, the Rav goes through this idea of Nachala, that a person is connected to a very particular inheritance. This is a psukim with reference to Navot. And Achav, of course, took away his kerem, and he said, "Chalilali me Hashem ititi et nachalat avotai lach," etc., etc. Man is rooted in his nachala, and interesting, the Rav here, by the way, refers to another drasha that he gave in 1951. Now, I will be honest; I was not there. However, I'm aware of it, of the drasha. The Rav compared Kayin to Hevel. In what sense? Why is it that we find the Torah, everyone knows the story of Cain and Hevel. Vayavi Cain mipri ha'adama michal Hashem, v'hevel hebi gamu mibcharot tzano v'chel v'hen, v'yisha Hashem el Hevel v'yam minchato, v'yal Cain v'yam minchato lo sha'a, v'yichal ha'kai bo, v'yipu panav, and the whole discussion that the Torah actually has subsequently. So the Rav was concerned about the following issue, and that drasha that he gave was the first Yahrzeit Shir he said for his father, who passed away in right around, actually, this is 1941. Did I say 51? 1941. His father passed away in 1940. The Rebbe at that time took over, replaced his father, I think a few months later. And this is the first Yahrzeit Shir that Rav Soloveitchik said for his father, 1941. I'm sorry, I correct myself. And so Rav Soloveitchik spoke about Cain and Hevel. And what he pointed out was the following. What profession did Cain have, and what profession did Hevel have? Cain was, Torah says, Hevel, Roitzon, V'Kayin, The Rav is concerned, how is it the Kain was able to do what he did? Namely, he prevailed over Hevel, he killed Hevel. How was he successful? So the Rav presented the following suggestion. Kain was Ober Adama. Namely, he was anchored. He had Kedushat Makom. He was connected to a particular locus. Hevel was Navanat. What are Ra'itzotun? Ra'itzon are obviously wandering. They're always looking for, shall we say, areas that they could, their flock could graze, and pasture land, new pasture lands, or what have you. So the person who has a makom is often able to, shall we say, overcome someone she'en lo makom, who has no anchor. Okay, this is Soloveitchik. Here he alludes to this. He says, when torn away, he becomes a navanot. Of course, that was the punishment that was given to Kayin, namely, to become a restless vagabond, a dislocated being. Homelessness or brutalness is a curse. Man quests for nachala. Okay, but anyway, the rough point here, if you continue on the next page, page 31, again, you see that ultimately, even though man is cosmic, but on the other hand, there's a very significant aspect of man that he wants to be anchored. He has to come home, and the Rav interprets Psukim very fascinating. At shuvchal hadamaki yimenu lukachta ki afarata v'alafarata shuv. Asalvich, by the way, in another context, referred to Psukim relating to Shmuel HaNavi. You remember Shmuel HaNavi, undoubtedly. What did he do a good part of his life? He was both a Navi and a Shofet. And how does the Navi describe Shmuel? He was constantly wandering about, if you recall. However, at the end of the day, it says, Uchuvato haramata kisham beto. The Rav, by the way, used that pasuk in one of his rashot of tshuva. That's essentially what tshuva is all about. Eventually, man has to come home. Coming home means coming back to, shall we say, the makor, where man drifted and man ventured out and man went ahead and tasted and was torn from the world at large. And as a result, he really abandoned his very shavashim, his very roots. And the whole idea of tshuva is a return to one's roots. The Rav used that pasuk in one of his famous tshuvas Rashi. It's published in Ala Tshuva. You'll find it there. But here also the Rav Soloveitchik is describing two types of man. So if you look at the bottom of 31, he writes over here, the dust of which man was fashioned was not taken from all parts of the universe. Means according to this, shall we say, second understanding of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, but from a single spot on the mountain when an altar was many, many years later constructed. As we said before, each man is created from and attached to a single spot. The home from which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back. Then the Rav quotes from Robert Louis Stevenson, which is one of my father, Al Shalom's favorite poets. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill. And the Rav writes over here, occasionally when I'm at the airport on the top of 32, I happen to observe the loading of a double coffin containing the body of a Jew who has lived, worked, raised children, prospered, or failed in the United States. It's being shipped for burial to Eretz Yisrael. The mystery of the origin apparently casts a spell even on people who have few religious commitments. The modern secular Jew wants to rest in eternal peace in proximity to the site where the patriarchs found their rest. Ki ha'adam etz ha'sadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor. So he calls these two types of men. One is cosmo-conscious man, and one is origin-conscious man. Here, those are the two Mamari Chazal that the Rav sees in the Gemara Tzadet. And then he goes on to, once again, describe this a bit more at the bottom of 32. Cosmic man finds Hashem in the vastness and boundlessness of the cosmic drama. In the heavenly galaxies, billions of light years away, while homebound, origin-minded man finds God in the limitedness and narrowness of finitude, in the smallness of the modest home into which man was born, into which he, as the other would say, willy-nilly, returns. That's how he pronounced that word. He loved that word. He then discovers Hashem in the origin, in the source, in the center of the burning bush. Either infinity cannot gain God, or God, if he so wills it, addresses man from the dimensionlessness of a point. I just want to mention the Rav, in one of his famous shiurim, he refers to a Gemara in Brachas. Every shiur we have to mention something in Brachas, just for Rabbi Goldschmidt. Anyway, so there's a Gemara in Brachas that at the end of the last parak, where the Rav actually, and this is a very fascinating drasha, he distinguishes between a Beit Knesset and the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit Knesset belongs to whom? It is the home of the human being. That's our home. How do we know that? The Gemara says in the first parak of Brachot that Hashem comes to the Beit Knesset. And if there's no minyan, he gets very upset. That's a famous Lama Bati V'ein Ish, Karati V'ein Oneh. I came and no one is here. We are quite familiar with this phenomena. Anyway, so that's the Beit Knesset. So Beit Knesset, the Gemara says at the end of Bracha, Beit Knesset is Ki Beito, is my home. How do I know that? Because there's a din, also Gemara in Bracha. Le'olam yikadei zadam, shiur shnei p'tachim. You have to enter the Beit Knesset. You're not supposed to just stand in the back. You have to go into the Beit Knesset. Number three, number four, that what is the proper posture of a Beit Knesset? Sfaradim know this posture better than anybody else. Namely, what do you do most of the time? Not like Ashkenazim who bob up and down like yo-yos. But rather, what is the primary posture, says the Rambam, in the Beit HaKnesset? Sha yeshiva sham beyiskeh mitzvahi. You sit most of the time, with the exception of the Shriat Zibur. Obviously, or when you daven the Amidah, when you daven the Shmonesre, of course, then you stand. But otherwise, the ideal posture is yeshiva. Why? Shenemar, the Rambam quotes a pasuk, Ashrei, Yoshrei, Beitecha. That's a very striking pasuk to quote, because all the Rishonim don't agree with the Rambam. What does it mean, Ashrei Yoshrei Beitecha? Happy are those who dwell in your house, as happy are those who sit in your house. All the Rishonim are against the Rambam. And there are many proofs against the Rambam. For example, the pasuk says in Dvarim, it mentions, Vayeshu b'kadesh yamim rabim kayamim asher yishabten. Or, better example, Basukot teshuvu shivat yamim. The Gemara in Sukkah, Kol Ezrach b'Yisrael yeshuv basukot. What does that mean? It doesn't mean to sit in the Sukkah. How does the Rambam interpret? To sit. And the best proof is, on Sukkah's night, what is the minhag of Sfaradim of the Rambam? The Rambam says, the Kiddush is said in what kind of a position? Standing. Because then you're going to make the bracha leshei basukah, which the Rambam interprets means to sit. Sit, physically to sit in the sukkah. So that's the idea of a Beit Knesset. Why? Because it's our home. And when it's our home, you go into the home and you feel comfortable. And the Rambam also writes in Hilchot Tefillah, what is the proper tone that should exist in the Beit Knesset? Kavod. That's the proper tone. What about a Beit HaMikdash on the other hand? Is one allowed to sit in the Beit HaMikdash? No. Gemara Sanhedrin. Gemara says, Ein yeshiva ba'azara ela l'malchei Beit David bovad. Only Malchei Beit David are allowed to sit in the azara of the Beit HaMikdash. What is the posture of a Beit HaMikdash? We say it in the davening every morning. For those who come early enough to say that, namely, Vani berov chazdecha avo beitecha eshtachaveh. The posture in the Beit HaMikdash is eshtachaveh. Why is that so? Because the kind of atmosphere is not atmosphere of kavod, where I feel comfortable. Because whose home am I entering? The home of Hashem. The difference between the Beit Knesset, the Beit HaMikdash. One is the home of Hashem, and Hashem comes to visit. And here, we are visiting the home of Hashem. How do I know that the Beit HaMikdash is the home of Hashem? Because we say it in Psukim. Ki Beiti Beit Tfilah Yikarei L'chol Amim. It's His house. And we are coming to visit Hashem. The mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel. Correct? Mi Bikesh Zot Miyedchem Ramos Chatzerai, says the Navi. Who asks you to trample on the Mekom HaMikdash. And what is the proper atmosphere, not kavod, but rather yira. Again, tzvei dinim. Kavod versus yira. That's something which is also part of the dialectical tension. There is a, obviously, areas of commonality in the Beit HaMikdash and Beit HaKnesset, but there are also distinctions. Now, here they're all on page 33. Again, this is also a very well known question that the Medrash asks, and we don't really know the answer. Shlomo HaMelech asked the following question. And this question, by the way, is at the root of every Kabbalistic sefer that's been ever written and will ever be written, and that is, what is the most fundamental question that the Mekubalim ask? How could the world emerge, a finite world, from an infinite God? That's a contradiction in terms. How could the finite emerge from the infinite? Hashem is infinite, Ein Sof, correct? And Hashem is Memalei Kol Almin, Let Atar De Palumina. There's no place Hashem is not to be found. Who mekomo shel olam? Ve'ein ha'olam mekomo. So if that's the case, how does he create a finite world? Shlomo HaMelech asks this question right here on page 33. Ki ha'amnam yeshev elokim al aretz hinei ha'shamayim b'shmei ha'shamayim l'lech al guluha. Av ki ha'bayit hazeh ha'shem aniti. So what is the response? So the Rav says here, the logical answer to Solomon's question should have rendered the effort to construct the sanctuary futile, if not nonsensical. We would expect the wisest of all men, once formulating this question, to regret the construction and call off the dedication festivities. The Rav is getting a little dramatic over here. Nevertheless, he was not frightened. He did dedicate the sanctuary and speaks of it as the abode of the Almighty. And the answer is, how does Hashem descend from infinity to finitude, from boundlessness into the narrows of the sanctuary? The answer is Tzimtzum. Sod HaTzimtzum. I don't have a clue what it is, even though a fellow in my shul just translated Nefesh HaChayim, Avinoam Frankel Shlita, in two volumes, approximately 1,000 pages, called Nefesh HaTzimtzum. He spoke to me about it for the last 5 years, essentially, I got some insight a little bit, but Tzimtzum literally means the following. What did Hashem do? In order for finitude to emerge from the infinite, Hashem withdrew into himself, left a space, a halal space, a vacuum, and in that vacuum the world is there. That's the finite world. That's called Tzimtzum. Trust me, I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. I'm just saying over the words, the language. So here, the Rav goes on to say, and this is now on page 34, and he is now describing, again, these two aspects, which of course are very significant. It means on the one hand, there's cosmic man, and then there's the other, what he calls origin-minded man. I wasn't happy with that terminology, I must be honest with you, but that's how the Rav distinguishes between these two. And then his point is that when man is drunk with life, when he feels, on page 34, when he feels that living is a dignified affair, then he beholds God in infinity. In moments of ecstasy, Bochi nafshi es Hashem, Hashem Elokai, Godal Temod, Hod v'hadala vashta, Majestis Dei. That means God in his majesty, and addresses itself to happy man. However, with the arrival of the dark night of the soul, in moments of agony and black despair, when living becomes ugly and absurd, plainly nauseating, when man loses his sense of beauty and majesty, God addresses him not from the infinity, but from the infinitesimal, not from the vast stretches of the universe, but from a single spot in darkness which surrounds suffering man. It means that there are two different sides of the coin. On the one hand, of course, majestic man, who sees the boundlessness of Hashem's universe, what the Rav called cosmic man. On the other hand, there are obviously times when the situation is bleak, and like he describes here, something which is, whenever I read this, I start shaking. 11 years ago, my wife lay on her deathbed. I watched her dying, day by day, hour by hour. Medically, I could do little for her. All I could do was pray. However, I could not pray in the hospital. I could not find God in the whitewashed long corridors among the interns and the nurses. The need for prayer was great. I could not live without gratifying this need. The moment I returned home, I would rush to my room, fall on my knees, and pray fervently. God in those moments appeared not as the exalted, majestic king, but as a humble, close friend, brother, father. In such moments of black despair, he was not far from me. He was right there in the dark room. I felt his warm hand, kaviyachol, on my shoulders. I hugged his knees, kaviyachol. He was with me in the narrow confines of a small room, taking up no space at all. God's abiding in a fenced, infinite locus manifests his humility and love for man. In such moments, this is not majestic, but rather humilitas Dei, which resides in the humblest and tiniest of places, addresses itself to man. So, as you see over here, that, and maybe I'll just mention while I'm at it, that this is, if you will, a kind of dialectical morality. There's an ethic of majesty, an ethic of humility. That's how the Rav always sees everything in dialectical terms. And here, I just, if you recall in Kol Dodi Dofek, imagine that some of you may have explored that essay, which is an astounding essay. That essay was delivered by the Rav Yom HaTzmaut in 1956. Again, Chabal, that I was not present. I really should have been. But my neshama was undoubtedly there. Anyway, so in 1956, that's where the Rav talks about Ish HaGoral and Ish HaYehud, man of fate, the man of destiny. That's where he talks about the Nox and the Rav every time there was something that happened. Because, you know, Rav Soloveitchik's thesis, you're aware of the Beis Halevi, I said over all the time, using Parshas Miketz, that the entire, the sole purpose of the United Nations was to establish the State of Israel. That's clear. Nothing happened before then, and since then nothing has happened except for, as far as I'm concerned, wonton soup. Since I believe, what's the name of the fellow who's now the head of it?
Anton Kimu.
Yes, so I'm sure they have good wonton soup in the UN. That's the extent of it. So Rav Soloveitchik contended, it's very clear, the whole thing was the cause and effect. I spoke about it once. Sibam b'sovam, the Beis Halevi. Okay, I can't get to it right now. Ainley's man. But anyway, I'm just indicating that that was the entire function of the UN. And it was actually miraculous. You read about the fact that Harry Truman, wow, Harry Truman, that he decided to literally give approval to this founding of the state was also miraculous. Literally a nice nigla, unquestionably. Okay, but I'm going back to this notion here Even, for example, and so in Kol Dodito Feg, the Rav talks about philosophic solutions to the problem of evil. Evil is one of the major issues mentioned by the Neviim and Tanakh, the problem of theodicy, Tzadik Varalo, Rosh Hashanah. You have many Svarim in Tanakh, primarily Sefer Eov. Eov's concerned with this issue in a very serious way. I actually taught Eov for a number of years. I learned the Ramban on Eov, and then I wanted to understand the different approaches of the Chaverim of Eov, which I examined in the light of the Ramban. And at the end of the Ramban's parish, which is copious and absolutely non-ending, how does Ramban solve the problem of evil? Through Gilgulim. Everything. That's how we solve the problem of evil. So here I'm looking for some fantastic solution, and I came up with Gilgulim. So someone told me, don't worry, they told me. So I said, why shouldn't I worry? Because the problem is solved. Metempsychosis, transmigration of souls. That's what the gentleman tells me. So all these philosophic solutions to the problem of evil are very inadequate at both intellectual level because of our finite intellect, and emotionally because they deny the legitimacy of man's experience of suffering. That's what the Rav points out in this Kol Dodito Feg over there. And the halacha provides a practical response. Namely, what is the practical response? The answer is, what's a reaction to suffering? Tshuva. Tshuva enables man to take positive therapeutic action in response to adversity. It means we take a destructive experience and we turn it into a redemptive one. Another one of the Rav's favorite themes. The Rav used to speak about beauty, but of course he spoke about Beauty and the Beast. Namely, beauty can easily be, Rachmana Litzlan, can be a force that can be very, very destructive. It has many, many, throughout Tanakh, we know beauty leads to, often, unfortunately, sexual, how shall we describe it? Almost wantonness, without any discipline. And in order for beauty to be disciplined, it requires the Rav set up from the Vilna Gaon, that those of us, I think everyone says it on Friday night, Sheker Achein Vehevel Ayofi Isha Yirat Hashem Hi Titalal. What does the He refer to? Chein is Sheker, correct? And Yofi is Hevel, but Isha Yirat Hashem Hi. So the Gaon said He refers back to what? Chein and to Yofi. If a woman has Yirat Hashem, then the Chein that she has and the Yofi that she has takes on absolutely grandiose kind of vistas. But without it, then it is Sheker and Hevel. So here, that idea that beauty requires redemption is a very fundamental idea. And you remember that essentially, Rav Soloveitchik sees a tension, and I alluded to it earlier, between Adam 1 and Adam 2, which is not for now. But anyway, the fact of the matter is, these two types of men that the Rav speaks about here, which is the dual religious experience of majestis and humilitas, as he has here on page 35, and man is summoned by God to be ruler, to be king, to be victorious, and it goes on, the Rav, and at the end of the day, he indicates on page number 36 that Hashem left one aspect of creation incomplete. This is, by the way, a Ramchal idea. Avashar Chaim Lutzado everywhere, anyone who learns any from Ramchal, including Mesilat Yesharim. But primarily, of course, it's found not so much in Mesilat Yesharim, but more in Derech Hashem. And also found in Ramchal's other works, this idea that's mentioned here on page 36, the notion that we are involved in a creative gesture to control, to dominate a hostile environment. And so therefore we have two types of personalities. We have cosmic man, fashioned out of dust from the four corners of the earth. We have origin questing man from the Mizbeach, and those are inherent in human nature. And so of course, this distinction between the two, the Rav described here as well. And then if you look further, on page 37, let's go a bit further, I see our time is limited. The Rav goes on to describe here, he points out, even in terms of these two aspects, the majesty of God and the humility of God, there also, Rav Soloveitchik speaks about two different types of morality. But at the end, really, this is really another favorite theme of Rav Soloveitchik, namely, the ethics of victory, but on the other hand, the ethics of retreat. Even someone who's victorious ultimately has to know how to retreat, and this is what he writes here on page 37. Look at the bottom of 37. The ethic of retreat or withdrawal is rooted in the old mystery of Tzimtzum. Again, this is built into the very structure of human existence and constitutes the essence of halachic living. On the one hand, Hashem wants man to move forward and to maintain mastery over his surroundings. And look at page 37 here. On the other hand, man has to hold his headlong rush towards triumph and success. He has to be ready to retreat, to be defeated by higher authority. In other words, when left to itself, the human desire for victory can often be egocentric, can be self-aggrandizement, can be full of gaiva. And the fact of the matter is, if I'm, however, recognizing that I also can be defeated, then, of course, that person, of course, has achieved, really, the highest level of accomplishment. If you look at page 38, here again, the Rav in the second paragraph, listed as number 8, he writes, in what areas of human endeavor does Judaism recommend self-defeat? Those areas which man is most interested. We think we're going to find the summum bonum, the realization of my most cherished dreams, and in those areas we have to withdraw, we have to demonstrate our humility. And he writes, he gives the example of Akedas Yitzchak, and then on the next page, he describes something which he talks about very often, the Rav. Look at page 39. What of the ordinary person is there, for example, a more sensitive area in the lives of two young people than their love relationship? The principle of self-defeating action must govern the relationship in this area. Sex, if unredeemed, may turn into a brutal, ugly performance which man shares with the beast. Sex is therefore indeed a redemption. It must be purged of its coarseness and animality. What action did Judaism recommend man in order to achieve this purpose? Withdrawal and self-defeat. This, of course, is the Dinim of Nida, which has that sense of discipline that contain or that control or that somehow, shall we say, indicates that man is not always in a position to be victorious. Okay, Maskana, just to end, because I see we a minute left or so. So the point being, Rav Soloveitchik, in majesty and humility, that here's what he writes here on page 37. That Avraham Avinu was told to withdraw and to defeat himself by giving Yitzchak away. He listened, and Rav Soloveitchik at the end, at the end of this essay, basically, there's actually a footnote where he writes that Moshe Rabbeinu, unfortunately, he was less fortunate. He withdrew. His Moshe Rabbeinu looked upon Eretz Yisrael from a distance. Unfortunately, Hashem did not respond to his tefillot. But at the end of the day is that both are significant. Namely, man has to live with this tension between victory and defeat, advance and retreat. He has no assurance of how it's going to ultimately end. This is the nature of the dialectical tension built into the very, shall we say, persona of the human being. So we have here what I think are a number of very fundamental ideas, primarily the notion of halachta bidrachav, the notion of imitati odei, a favorite topic of Rav Soloveitchik, and I think that the notion of majesty and humility, which represent really what the human being is all about, we are constantly oscillating between the two. As I said at the very beginning, Ava and Yira, here is majesty and humility. These are two different aspects of the human being, and these are the two pockets of the Admor Mikotsk that I mentioned earlier, and these are dialectical ideas that are really built into the very nature of what man is all about. Okay.